But we have one more presentation, and then hopefully you'll all be able to stick around so that we can ask some questions of the presenters from this afternoon. Our final speaker for today is Dr. Sydney Bacchus. She received her bachelor's and master's degree from Florida State University, with her master's research on spatial changes in aquatic and wetland vegetation associated with a riverine system subjected to tidal influence. After receiving her master's degree in biology, she worked for state and regional environmental regulatory agencies in Florida for 10 years. She evaluated restoration projects for marine, estuarine, and freshwater systems, and the potential environmental aspects of permit applications. She worked on determining the extent of wetlands throughout Florida pursuant to state regulation, and served as an expert witness for the state in legal cases involving wetlands. Her graduate level training included courses in hydrology, hydrogeology, and geochemistry of karst aquifer systems. Her doctoral research at the Institute of Ecology focused on interactions of ground and surface water. Ground and surface water, with special emphasis on subsurface perturbations of wetland hydroperiod in the southeastern coastal plain. The culmination of her doctoral research was the development of an early detection mechanism of unsustainable groundwater withdrawals using pond cypress as a hydroecological indicator species. She worked for about 6 years as a hydroecologist for the Region 4 U.S. EPA lab in Athens, Georgia, and completed an internship and fellowship, 1998 and 99 respectively, on phytoremediation for the U.S. EPA National Exposure Research Laboratory in Athens. Her doctoral research was supported in part by grants from the Florida Department of Environmental Regulation, which is now the Department of Environmental Protection, the USGS, and the USDA Forest Service. She's produced more than 30 peer-reviewed publications, including books and book chapters, and has been an invited speaker at several international conferences. Her research interests include the role of anthropogenic groundwater perturbations in ecological decline, including estuarine and marine ecosystems, and phytoremediation by native wetland species. The talk title today is Field Assessments of Landscape Scale Mining Impacts Based on Spectroscopic Analysis.
But she's a Mac person and she can't operate this PC. So she's going to defer to our techno wizard. Okay, thank you.
And if you can catch up about 20 minutes that we lost in a hole somewhere.
Right. Fortunately, the stage was set well for me by Todd Kincaid's presentation, so I won't have to dwell on the basics of a karst aquifer system. But what I did want to point out is that this is the extent of the regional Floridan aquifer system. It doesn't stop here at the coast. It goes out to the platform on either side, and that's something that people really don't grasp, but it is important. And it's important because the mines inland will, in fact, have an impact on that groundwater discharge to coastal areas as well as to terrestrial areas. Now, these areas here, these are sub-regional areas of the Florida aquifer system that were subdivided by USGS when they did a modeling project years ago. I'm going to be using a lot of graphics that are not my graphics. They'll be cited down here. In most cases, these are USGS publications, and I won't go into detail about the authors, but the authors are credited there. Now, I wanted to make this point because you do hear repeatedly, oh, there's no karst in our area. There may be karst up here, or there may be karst over there, but there's no karst down here, or here, or here, or here. So when I did my doctoral research, I selected field sites for long-term research in all of these sub-regions so that I could compare what was happening from impacts in groundwater surface water interaction in each of those sub-regions, which of course a lot of the geological realm will say, oh, these are very different. And they may be very different with respect to the rock strata, but with respect to the environmental impacts, they are identical, regardless of what sub-region you're in. Now, the ranges of numerous native animal and plant species in Florida coincide with the extent of the Florida aquifer system that I just showed you. Pond cypress is just one of many examples that of plants and animals that are within that range. Pond cypress occur in depressional areas and are not isolated. You'll hear them constantly referred to as isolated wetlands from a regulatory standpoint. They are not, in fact, isolated. They are one of the more connected wetlands, and they have direct connections to the underlying aquifer system. So this is a cutaway that was actually a title cover page by a multi-agency report. Maddox actually was in the Florida Geological Survey that Todd was just mentioning within DEP. And it shows you a cross-section. So here's a pond cypress wetland that is called an isolated wetland. This is a karst feature natural lake. Here is a depressional marsh system, an herbaceous system, again, not isolated, depressional. And you'll see that underlying all of these, there are a series of conduits, there are a series of fracture systems, so that if, in fact, you're doing a mine, back excavating a mine in this area, through these subsurface features, it will have very significant impacts on these depressional wetlands here, here, these karst lake systems here. So in actuality, it can affect these natural systems miles from the actual mine site. Even though the monitoring system, the monitoring networks rarely go beyond the actual footprint of the mine or the boundaries of the mine site. Now, these cross-sections were actually done by a study that was funded jointly by the, well, it was funded by the Southwest Florida Water Management District, and the work was done jointly by them and the Department of Geology at the University of South Florida. What they found, of course, the theory was that here are these isolated wetlands, which are actually depressional wetlands, and they would have a thin peat layer of varying degrees, and then they might have a sand layer underneath or a shell layer, which is actually the superficial aquifer, and then they would have low permeability zones. In this case, that's a clay layer, and this is a marl layer, and then the underlying limestone aquifer, which is the Florida. They had municipal wells out there into the Florida. They started pumping their models, which were based exactly on the type of model that Todd showed you, which was flow through porous medium, said there will be no response in the superficial aquifer. That's what the models told them. Well, the models told them that because they had set the model parameters in such a fashion that they instructed the models that there would be no flow between the Florida and the superficial. So the cattlemen and the local residents around the rural natural lakes repeatedly told them otherwise. And finally, a biologist went out, one of the district biologists went out to the site, and in fact, the site, the depressional wetlands on their well field sites were being dewatered. So the ground was cracking and there were big fissures, and that's when they decided, they would do enhancement of the hydroperiod by pumping more water out of the Florida, which of course was the cause of the dry down in the first place, and just kind of tossing some of that water in through a pipe into these various wetlands to rehydrate them. And those wetlands were the ones that had the most rapid death of trees, were the ones that they hydrated with the deep Florida aquifer water. But what they did do is they went out and they did a very impressive geophysical study where they actually did borings, and they used a number of different geophysical techniques. What they found, in fact, was that it was not this continuous layer of these low permeability zones, but in fact, they discovered that they were relic sinkholes. These depressional wetlands were relic sinkholes, and that the strata were not continuous. that these strata had slumped down and then infilled, and then the wetland had established over it over thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. So if you have a site anywhere in Florida, regardless of what county you're in, and it has pond cypress on it, I can guarantee you, you've got karst features right there. Now, the unfortunate thing is that right now, the regulatory agency, meaning the Corps of Engineers, because they treat those as isolated wetlands, they basically either don't require a permit for them at all, or just hand you a permit and require no mitigation, and then the mine site goes through them, and where is the mine site located? It is located precisely at the point that has the greatest connection to the underlying Florida aquifer. So that's problematic. Now, I have this little schematic that seems to help people grasp why there are problems with the superficial aquifer, despite the fact that I've actually read in the past couple of days a number of permits that were issued at a local level where there were repeated statements that there would be no effect to the superficial aquifer from the mine pits. Now, if you look at this cubic area here, there's a little inverted triangle that signifies that that's where the water level is. So if you pretend that this is the surface in a low-lying area of Florida where the water table is at or near the surface, and that cube is filled with some type of aquifer matrix material that they want to mine, whether it is sand or rock or shale, and then there are spaces in between that aquifer matrix material. And those spaces, the pore spaces, that's what's filled with water. Now, the standard value that they use for a porous material in Florida is about 0.2 or 20%. So if you figure that this cube has 20% water and 80% matrix, and they mine that cube and say maybe this is a 1 acre mine pit, or you multiply that by 250 if it's a 250 acre mine pit, then if there was no movement of water through any of those sides or the bottom of the mine, then that water table is going to drop to the 20% mark. That's inevitable. Now, we're assuming that rainfall is going to be constant, so we're ignoring that. We're pre-mine and post-mine, and we're assuming that evaporation is going to be constant. This is just what's going to happen if you take the solid material out of this cube. Now, in reality, we know for a fact that water flows through all of those surfaces. It flows up and down, and it flows sideways, and it flows through the pits, and that was shown in the Miami-Dade pits when they actually did the tracer studies down there. So what that means is that water table will not be down here. It'll be somewhere up here. It can never be where it was before, up here, before the material was taken out. That's physically impossible because the water molecules can't suspend themselves in that pit without that solid matrix anymore. So what that means is that water will be flowing into and probably through that pit, possibly even up into that pit, and that's going to be problematic for whatever is located on the perimeter, you know, and how far out that impact zone extends. And as Todd just showed you, it's extremely difficult to figure out exactly where that impact zone is going to be. Now, when he showed you that model that they had done where they had put in that theoretical karst conduit in that Lee County corkscrew mine pit, they located that theoretical karst conduit there because, in fact, that corresponded with the impacts that I had observed in the environmental components of the area around that mine. That was the area that was actually showing physical effects in the vegetation on the top of the mine. So they put that theoretical conduit at that location and then contoured it, and in effect that impact zone corresponded pretty closely, surprisingly, for a very quick and dirty model. It corresponded very closely with where I was seeing the impacts on the ground and the vegetation. Now, this is a figure that was done in a publication that came out, I believe, in 2006, where I actually took values that had been provided in a Corps of Engineers impact study for the pit belt in Miami-Dade County. And I included also some factors that aren't really considered when they evaluate what the impacts of these pits are going to be. And here's our rainfall. We held that constant. Here's pre-mining, 54 inches a year. That was what was the rainfall in that area. We're assuming it's the same, of course. Now our rainfall pattern, at least for the short term, has changed, so we're getting less rainfall annually. But anyway, if you assume it stays constant, here's your water level up here. Under this circumstance where you have historic evaporation and transpiration, or ET, pre-mine conditions, that's a loss of 44 inches per year. Now that gives you a recharge to your aquifer system of 10 inches per year. So 10 inches of recharge per year per acre. So then you calculate how large your mine site is to determine what the change is going to be. Now here, after you excavate the mine pit, your water table drops some level for some extent beyond the mine. And what happens is your pit evaporation increases. And that increase was based on what the pit evaporation rates were. That's how they arrived at that figure, 63 inches per year. And these were all figures that they had done studies on and come out in published literature. Now, what happens is that the evaporation rate over the unmined area no longer remains at 44 inches per year. Because what happens because of the drawdown, despite the fact that it may be a very slight drawdown, and I believe, you know, I've heard engineers and maybe even some PGs repeatedly say it's an insignificant drawdown. Well, it may be an insignificant drawdown with respect to water supply, but it is most certainly not an insignificant drawdown with respect to the environmental components around those wells. And you can tell that because they fall over dead. It's pretty easy to see. So what happens is, here we had a natural system where you had little cypress trees growing in the wetter areas, the native pines growing here. Their tap roots are tapped into that. And they're basically, that's their buffer system. When it's not the rainy season, or when the rainfall is low, they don't have to worry because they're tapped into the superficial aquifer. When the superficial aquifer drops down below where their access point is for their roots, their buffer system's gone. So what happens is the pines die, the cypress die, and what happens is you get invasive species like Melaleuca. Melaleuca are not conservative transpirers like the native trees. So what happens is your loss in this case it's transpiration, increases from what the native conditions were at 44 inches per year. In this case, it increases to 51 inches per year. So you're not only increasing your water loss over the pit, but you're also increasing your water loss in the surrounding areas. So in this scenario, instead of having a recharge to your aquifer system of 10 inches per year, you end up with a minus 9 inches of recharge. And minus 9 inches of recharge is not recharge. That's discharge. So that's loss of water from your aquifer system. And that is what I've termed non-mechanical dewatering. So when you go to get a permit from the Water Management District, they will ask you if you're going to be pumping, if you're going to be dewatering. And of course the answer is, you know, if you're not going to be pumping, the answer that they give is no, we're not going to be dewatering. But in reality, it's kind of like Dr. Weisskopf's true false test. You know, that answer is false. They will, in fact, be dewatering. They just won't be using pumps to dewater. So there was a study that came out in 2000, I think that's important, and this was out of USGS's Orlando office. They basically studied natural lakes in Polk County. Star Lake was one of the lakes that they looked at. In that particular case, the rainfall in the area that they used was 51.99 inches per year. And they found that that was actually a little higher than the 30-year average, which was only 48. So basically, they were working in a wet year when they did that study. And they found that lake evaporation, these are real lakes, 57.08 inches per year and 55.88 inches. This was a two-year study, and the lake was 134 acres. And they compared that to Lake Lucerne from an earlier study in 85 to 86. And in that particular case, the loss of water from that lake was 57.87 inches per year. And their conclusion was that if net precipitation to the lakes is negative over the long term, then the ability to generate net groundwater flow from surrounding basin, meaning flow into those lakes, is going to play an important role in maintaining those lake levels. Now, if you're going around digging a bunch of pits, you're basically creating more areas with excessive loss of evaporation. They also discovered that when they looked at, compared the values that they actually measured as evaporative loss from the lake surfaces, they found that those were higher than the pan evaporation measurements that were given and routinely used in the models. So they attributed the possibility of positioning of the pan. So actually, what they were saying is that the pan evaporation rates are artificially conservative because of a whole list of factors that they discussed in the report. Now, what I'm going to do is talk about the hydrological alterations as an environmental stressor here. And that's my expertise. Now, US EPA's Scientific Advisory Board in 99 evaluated what they considered the 33 top environmental stressors to ecosystems. The number one stressor, hydrologic alteration. Now, they're looking at things like climate change. Where was climate change as an environmental stressor? Number four, climate change. So what I did was I went through, out of those 33 stressors that they identified, I've highlighted in yellow all of the other stressors that actually culminate as a result of the hydrologic stressors. You will get, guaranteed, habitat conversion when you have hydrologic stressors. You will get alien species invasion when you have hydrologic alteration. You will get habitat fragmentation, disease and pest outbreaks, like the beetle attacks that Tom Ornke talked about in his presentation. You will get physical habitat disruption. You will get altered fire regime. And when you hear them say all those catastrophic fires in Florida are because of the drought, it is not so. Not the case. There was another paper that I put out in 2007 that discussed that. Now I'm going to very quickly just address the major components here. This was put together by Paul Moeller when the agency was still Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission. And basically he was showing that all of these amphibians in Florida, these are various different frog species which serve as a critical bottom level of the food chain for all those things like the roseate spoonbills that everybody likes to look at and those wood storks. When you're looking at the higher levels of the food chain, you're looking at amphibians, and it's an important point. So here are four species that have to have very shallow water for 20 to 70 days during a certain period of the year, or they can't get their eggs to tadpole, from tadpole stage to frogs. So they've got a group here which has these specific requirements, a second group of frogs that have these specific requirements of water depth, the period of time that the water is there, and also the time of year that the water is there. So what that means is if you're disrupting that hydro period, the length of time the water's there, the time of the year it's there, how deep it is, you're wiping out entire levels of your ecosystem. Now, what I did in my doctoral research was I used spectral analysis, and I actually looked at different times of the years and found that, as I had predicted, the winter data set would be the best data set for predictive values, and it turned out to be highly correlated with my assigned stress classes. Now, the assigned stress classes, I use indicators that have been commonly used by forest pathologists for many years, and I actually did spectroscopic analysis, keyed in with those indicators, and found that the stress classes, based on the visual indicators of premature decline, which is basically chronic stress, such as groundwater alterations, in each region of the Florida and aquifer system were highly correlated. The predictive accuracy, which was different. Now, I then created two models, models for different years, and I used the data set from one year to try to predict what was going to happen the next year and vice versa. And the accuracy, the predictive accuracy, was 100% for one year and 97% for the next, and that is extremely high. What I did was use partial least squares linear discriminant analysis of second derivative spectral transformations in the near infrared region for my spectroscopic analysis. Now I'm going to show you examples of what this looks like in the field. This was actually in the Pasco Hillsborough area, and that was from a supply well. What you get is basal decay. This is where the bottoms of the trees rot out because they used to be under an anoxic level of saturated soil or water. They fall over. That's called wind throw. Really doesn't have anything to do with the wind. It just has to do with the fact that the bottom of the tree rotted. What you'll have here is there'll be subsidence around the base. This is a cypress knee, and I think that it's similar to tooth decay because you've got this area around the submerged portion of the root zone that doesn't have that protective coating like when you get gum recession and your teeth rot. I think there's a similar analogy there. These are other indicators. This is pine trees that have had the tap root rot off, and so the superficial roots are not capable of holding the tree intact. You don't get as much canopy loss with the pine, so it's more difficult to see. This is canopy decline in the pine cypress. Here's another long leaf that had a tap root that rotted off. It looks kind of like a stump from a war vet that stepped on a landmine and just blew his leg off. These are sinkholes that were opening. This is in the wilderness preserve area where they've got the well fields in Pasco County. A lot of Spanish moss. Don't really know why that happens, but it is one of the best indicators of premature decline. Now, these are pond cypress branches. This was taken from my site in the Myakka State Park. And what happens is you get branch dieback, which is the tips. This is one entire year's growth on the tips of these branches. And this is spring. And what happens is in spring you should have full leaf out all the way to the branch tips. And what you're getting in these areas with groundwater alterations is no leaf out on the tips. So then that year that branch segment drops off and the branches get shorter and shorter and shorter until it's just the trunk of the tree just standing there. So you also get a dense undergrowth of shrubby or woody species coming in. Again, the subregions, I'm going to quickly show you examples in all of these subregions. Hamilton and Taylor counties, Putnam County, Volusia County. That also should have included Indian River County. I'm going to show you some examples there. So here are Hamilton and Taylor. This was the Econ River, magnificent river in the Big Bend Panhandle area. It used to flow out to the Gulf. Done anymore, right next to Ghana mine, but no correlation yet in any studies. Nobody's actually looked at it other than me. This was the Putnam County area. You've seen this today. This was an area that is the northern reach of Putnam County where they mined. There was a big prairie system here, Goodson Prairie, that was dewatered from the mines. This was unnamed lake. They don't need to name it now because it's not there anymore. And this was a sand mine complex here. I'm going to show you some new sinkhole openings around Smith's Lake over here and then what Deep Lake looks like. Here's your scale bar, 0.3 miles, so this is easily a mile from the site. This was Deep Lake. Deep Lake's kind of shallow in this picture. But the natural high water line was way up here where the tree line was. You can see by this dock that the water used to be a lot deeper. This whole zone was this magnificent herbaceous wetland. And it's all pretty much died. It hasn't yet been invaded by invasives, but that will be a coming attraction. And here are some shots from the former soil level was about up here, and you can see all of this subside as the trees now look like they're creeping around on little spider legs. The prairie, we walked out there, and the organics are cracking. You can stick your hand way down in these fissures and see the water. A lot of subsidence and loss of organic. This was property back on the other side of Smith Lake, and big sinkholes were opening up there. Here are some other shots of sinkholes that have opened around Putnam. I didn't actually take these shots, but this was a well driller who was out there trying to drill a new residential well, and all of a sudden the earth started rumbling in. The next thing he knew, his drilling rig was swallowed up. Here was a new one that I did find while I was doing the site inspection in 2005. This simply shows differences in, here's the 1949 USGS quadrangle map before they were mining extensively in that area. And then you can actually see how a lot of these lakes have receded. Now they don't necessarily all go down at the same time or to the same degree because, as Todd was showing, they can be connected in various degrees to those conduit systems. That's just an area where they wanted to put the new mine. Rob Brinkman was talking about that wildlife corridor area, and that's where they wanted to put it there. I'm going to skip those. And this is a view of the mines to the south. And now I'm going to show you, this is a 1.5 mile location. I'm going to show you some pictures here and there that are the result of the mines in this area. And that was, this was subsidence here. Here the roots, the tap roots have rotted off of the pines and they're falling over. You've got invasive species. Like skunk vines and other aggressive vines in the area, and then you've also got canopy decline and for what the trees that haven't already fallen over. This is private property that is also about 1.5 miles from the mine where they had turkey oaks. Now, you know, I don't want to give anybody the misimpression that these impacts only occur in wetlands. The so-called xeric habitats in Florida are highly susceptible to these impacts, and I think that's because the groundwater mounds under these sandy areas, the plants that are considered xeric, many of them actually tap into that superficial aquifer mound, and when that mound is dropped out from under them, they're history. So all of those turkey oaks have died. I did look at the rainfall patterns. The rainfall really hasn't changed that much since they started collecting it back at the beginning of the century. And it's pretty consistent across the state on both sides of that area in the center part of the state where they're mining. Very quickly, the Volusia County areas as small as this so-called stormwater pond that is next to I-95. This was a pond cypress wetland in the background there, and you can see a lot of the trees are already dead. They're losing their canopy just from this small stormwater pond. This was another small pond. This is actually a fill area that was dug for this small house, and it's affecting this wetland in the back. Now, rim ditches, this was another shot of an area. I actually went out with no knowledge whatsoever of where the mine pits were in the western part of Indian River County. I went out and simply looked for vegetative indicators. Found this, got a GPS coordinate on it, gave it to one of the local guys, who then plotted it in to a GIS system map, which located it precisely across the highway system from the mine that was in there, but you couldn't actually see from the road. And he was absolutely astounded that I could go out there, you know, in miles and miles and miles and miles of area, walk right up to a point that was directly across from a mine that you could not see from the road. So anyway, I guess turned him into a believer. One important point I wanted to make is that you will hear with most of these mines that they're going to put a recharge ditch around it, or a rim ditch, and they're going to use that rim ditch and recharge ditch to protect everything that needs to be preserved. Well, here's a wetland that they did a rim ditch around, and this was a pond cypress wetland again. Real small relative to the mines, very small ditch. Here's the system right here, has completely destroyed that wetland, that rim ditch, with no mining, just the rim ditch. So for them to say that the rim ditch is going to preserve the areas, you know, from impacts from the mine, is another big false. These are the ones that are the phosphate mines right here. These are the mosaic mines that either exist or they've got ones that are proposed. There is a Manatee Duet Preserve, 1.5 miles south of the Jameson Tract Mine and adjacent to the proposed Altman Tract Mine. And there's a big sign talking about the funding acquisition and the preservation, and I can assure you that if that Altman Tract Mine is approved by Manatee County, that preserve is history. It will not be here within 10 or 15 more years. So these are areas in that vicinity, this is north of that preserve area, that already have been affected by the mines further to the north. This is west of 37. This is east of 37. That was during a recent site inspection that I made. These are more wetlands west of 37. All these, you can see the dense coat of Spanish moss completely covering the canopy. That tree has no hope of being able to produce food for itself because no leaves will be seen the light of day. So this whole wetland here has been invaded by all kinds of nuisance species, both alien and natives, and is changing from a forested wetland system into invasive species wetland. This was an area that was actually in that same vicinity, but this was the wetland is to the back of that, and that area caught fire and burned up in a controlled burn. This was actually north of that area that caught fire during the big I-4 crash where they had the massive pileups. And that, in my opinion, was the result of the mining activities in the vicinity of I-4. So this is just quickly the Melaleupas that come in. These were the local Washington Loop areas. Existing mines, relatively small, and the proposed mines. And then that's an aerial view. This was an area that burned up that was south of the mine. These are trees that are dying in people's backyards. It was a big natural area to the south of those mines, the two relatively small mines that are already there. And then that's Myrtle Slough, And this is a wetland area that has already been impacted by the very small mine over here. There was a very small spring that used to feed that area. Manatee would come up, and that spring stopped discharging after the mine was dug. And this is the corkscrew one. I'll just very quickly go through these. These were back in 2003, the Schmitz property there. And then that's what it looked like in 2007. You can see much more extensive death. And these are the preserved wetlands. These are the conservation wetlands on the mine site, completely overrun with dog fennel now in the understory, and the trees are starting to fall over the pond cypress trees. Subsidence. And these are, Kevin Hill actually had to bring in, there's been, in my opinion, such a lowering of the land surface that the people, like Peg was saying, the uplands now they're calling wetlands, and it appears that that's because the whole land surface is sinking to the extent that now, when they do get the rains, the land surface is lower and they have water. Quite deep. He had to bring in fill for his driveway just so he could get from the road to his house because his property is now flooding like crazy. Melaleuca coming in there. And that, I'd like to kind of end on an upbeat note. There was a mine proposed up in Bay County. I'm sorry, not Bay County. I believe it was Washington County. And this is a magnificent spring-fed system up there that still hasn't been overrun with algae from sewage and is still flowing because right now there aren't the mines up there, but they have been proposed. So I think that's about problematic permit conditions, and I'll just leave you with that.